Hello and welcome to Cinema Chat with David Heath. And I am your humble host, David Heath. And I'm going to have a little bit of a different kind of episode today. We are going to be talking about Zorro and the various film variations of Zorro. At first, I'm going to just kind of dive in and talk a little bit about each Zorro film. And, of course, we have Douglas Fairbanks, and we have Tyrone Power, Guy Williams, and George Hamilton, and Antonio Banderas. And there are other adaptations that are not American adaptations. We're going to limit it to the American adaptations. And I'm also pleased to be able to have a good, fun Zoom call with Tracy Gozel, one of my favorite people. She is in charge of the Biograph Project, and she is trying to restore all of the Biograph films, and those are some of the early silent films from the very, very earliest ones, and it was starring Mary Pickford and all kinds of stars, the D.W. Griffith movies, and we are pleased to have her on the show for the third time. To talk about why she thinks Douglas Fairbanks is the best Zorro. And she wrote the book about Douglas Fairbanks called The First King of Hollywood. And be sure and look up on Facebook, if you're on Facebook, look up the Biograph Project and like that page. And please consider donations to it, because it does cost money. And Tracy has been generous enough to the general public to put some of her own monies into this project, and it's just really great that she's done that, and we really appreciate her being a champion of silent film. I wanted to tell you that some of our conversation is a little bit esoteric, and so we had a little bit of a fun conversation. A tiny bit of it is personal, because I was lucky enough to meet her in the Kansas Silent Film Festival 2 years ago, before COVID started. But anyway, here we go. So let's just dive right on in into the episode about Zorro and Zorro movies. The idea of Zorro was created by Johnson McCauley in 1919. He wrote a book called The Curse of Capistrano. The man Zorro fought injustice in Spanish California. Zorro is Spanish for fox, just so you know. And the story takes place in the 1850s. And what I want to do is I want to break down each of the American Zorro films. And, well, when I say break down, we're going to talk about it. We're not going to break it down each one and take an hour to do so, but we're going to go ahead and talk about each one, and I'm going to give it a rating at the end, and it's going to be interesting to see how people might agree or disagree with this. First, Douglas Fairbanks. Well, we know how our friend Tracy Gozel feels, but this movie was made in 1920. His version, directed by Fred Niblo. I hope I say that right. Tracy might be able to correct me on that. 44 credits, and Fred Niblo had. This was his first big film, but he would go on and do The Three Musketeers, also with Doug Fairbanks, and Blood and Sand with Rudolph Valentino, and Thy Name is Woman, starring Ramon Navarro and Barbara Lamar. He also did Ben-Hur in the 1925 version, and did several pre-code films before his retirement. Douglas Fairbanks, this was a big breakout film for him too. He of course went on to also star in The Three Musketeers and Robin Hood, The Thief of Baghdad. Doug Fairbanks is the first king of Hollywood. Before Gable and Bogart, there was Douglas Fairbanks. He played Don Diego Vega, who sees the government and rich oppress the little people, and he tries to help them out. Fairbanks' daring stunts show his athleticism and amazing physical skills. It also gives us a chance to see how charismatic Fairbanks is. He would show that more, even more so in Robin Hood and the Three Musketeers. He was a very flamboyant actor and just really exuded charisma. Noah Beery also makes an appearance in this film, one of dozens of appearances in film history. Marguerite De La Motte was the love interest multiple times in her career, but she had a 24-year film career. And I think that the main thing that this film does is it gives Doug Fairbanks a platform to show how talented of a leading man he was. He was good looking, he was flamboyant, he was fun, he was funny, and he just exuded confidence and just looked like a movie star. And this film displays one of the first true movie stars that Hollywood ever saw, and Douglas Fairbanks. This taps out an hour and 19 minutes. And that's one of the things I think is lovely about this film. I have to admit I'm a little biased for several reasons. One is, Tracy Gosnell she's come on the show twice, and she talked about her book about Doug Fairbanks. And I'm also a little biased because I saw the movie on the big screen, in the oldest movie theater in America, which is in Ottawa, Kansas, of all places. It's about an hour south of Kansas City. But anyway, I think it's just a rich film, and there's so much to see. And Doug Fairbanks is dashing, and Marguerite De La Motte is beautiful, and I love this film, and I give it 4 out of 4 stars. In one of Hollywood's first sequels, there was a sequel to the Zorro movie in 1920. Don Diego Vega appears again, in the movie called Son of Zorro in 1925. He plays Don Diego Vega again, but he also plays the son. So it's a dual role. Excellent performance by Douglas Fairbanks. English actor Donald Crisp plays the villain Don Sebastian, and Mary Astor plays in the film as well. She is, this is really her first big role in an extraordinary long career, including The Maltese Falcon with Humphrey Bogart many years later. Lottie Pickford also shows up in the film. She appears as Lola, and she is the sister of Mary Pickford. Donald Crisp also directed this film. The film probably is his biggest project as a director. Son of Zorro is very entertaining, and we see more of why Douglas Fairbanks was such a big star. And the film is somewhat of an excuse to make an extra film, but it still scores 3 stars in my book out of 4, but not quite as good as the original, of course. And the next film is called The Bold Caballero in 1936. Zorro gets tried for murder in this one. Robert Livingston plays Don Diego, and also Zorro, of course. He was a B-movie star, and this is really a B-movie. And let's see, Sig Ruman, very legendary actor, plays Don Sebastian in this villain. This is an early film appearance for him. Heather Angel plays Lady Isabella Palma, the love interest known for voice work much later in her career. She performed in Peter Pan and Alice in Wonderland, both of the Disney versions. The Bold Caballero falls very short of being a great movie. It is only 1.5 stars. But the next film on our list is Zorro's Fighting Legion, 1939. It's a Republic picture, and Republic Pictures, if you're not familiar with, Republic Pictures basically is the, it's not MGM, it's not Warner Brothers, and it's not even Universal. It's kind of like second tier, not B movie per se, but I mean, because, you know, John Wayne starred in Republic Pictures. But it was a lesser production company, but we'll just say it that way. And but so some of the films are wonderful out of Republic Pictures, it just had lesser budgets is pretty much the bottom line. B-movie star Reed Hadley stars as Zorro in this one. Sheila Darcy plays Bolita, the love interest. C. Montague Shaw plays the villain Don Del Oro. This was actually somewhat like what a Netflix series would be like today, you know, like a limited series. There's several episodes, and then it's over. And that's kind of what this was in 1939. It's a little tedious to watch every episode. But I give it 3 stars. And out of 4, that is. And the next one is what some people may argue for. The Mark of Zorro, 1940. Directed by Robin Mamillion. I don't know. I can never say his name right. Who also directed Blood and Sand, which we covered on the podcast with the lovely Jeannie Von Jazz, and we need to have her back on the show sometime. He also directed Queen Christina with Greta Garbo, big film. And he also directed Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, the 1931 version, who we also covered, which you also covered with Jeannie Von Jazz. And this one stars Tyrone Power and Linda Darnell, and who also would star a year later in Mamillion's Blood and Sand. They would also star in that one. Tyrone Power is charismatic and fun, but he doesn't quite top Doug Fairbanks, in my opinion. I'm not going to say he's stiff by any stretch, but he's not as charismatic and not as fun, and didn't seem to be having quite as much fun as Douglas Fairbanks did with his role. And I know there's going to be a lot of people that will shake their fists at me, but I just really like the Doug Fairbanks version better. Tyrone Power would also go be in Blood and Sand, Nightmare Alley, which is a great film, Witness for the Prosecution, great role in that. We covered, we haven't covered Witness for the Prosecution. That's one movie we need to cover. He unfortunately died at age 44 of a heart attack. Linda Darnell died at age 41 in a house fire. She had an up and down career, but had several projects going on at the time of her death. And she was named, or should I say, she was just thought of to be one of the bigger actresses at that time, I should say. Basil Rathbone is the villain in this movie. You would know him most for being in the 14 Sherlock Holmes films that he starred in. Gail Sondergaard played Inez Quintero, and legendary character actor Eugene Pallette is also in the film. 263 credits, by the way. And DeMarco Zorro, I give 3.5 stars out of 4. I really love the film, and if there was no Douglas Fairbanks version, this would easily be the best. But it is, as I would say, maybe second best right now. We have also Zorro the Avenger, in which was a Disney production. Disney had put together a bunch of episodes of Zorro, and they end up smooshing them all together and making a couple of movies out of it. Kind of a strange scenario, but, you know, it made a few people happy. Guy Williams plays Zorro in these films, and Henry Calvin and Gene Sheldon, I would argue, really are the heroes of this movie, of this production, because they are a lot of fun. They have Laurel and Hardy type humor, and I give this 2.5 out of 4 stars. And then we would have The Mark of Zorro, 1974, which was a TV movie made and it came on ABC. Starred Frank Langella as Zorro. Had Ricardo Montalban as Captain Esteban. And Yvonne DiCarlo, the beautiful and great Yvonne DiCarlo, shall we say. And Ann Archer. And an early role for her. Good actors, but mediocre script and overall production kind of sabotages what any kind of good the actors can do. It looks like a TV movie, and it just drips like it. It's a 2-star film out of 4. Like it, don't love it. The next production, Zorro production, is more of a parody. And it is called Zorro the Gay Blade, 1981. If you have not seen it, and you get offended very easily, you do not want to see it. If you have not seen it and you really love politically incorrect humor, this is your movie. George Hamilton stars as Don Diego Vega. He also stars as Zorro, of course. And he also stars as Zorro or Don Diego Vega's gay brother, Bunny Wigglesworth, / Ramon Vega. So it's Zorro and Bunny Wigglesworth are the heroes of this film. It also stars Lauren Hutton as Charlotte, the love interest, and it is peak Lauren Hutton. She is just absolutely just beautiful in this movie. Ron Liebman, great, great character actor, had an opportunity to play a role that he obviously relished, as Captain Esteban. He looked like he was just having fun in this film, and it's an awesome performance by him. Also a great performance by Brenda Vaccaro, playing his hilarious wife. This movie is so much fun. We'll go ahead and give it, we're going to give it 3.25 stars, really. Let's just go ahead and say 3.5 stars. For Zorro the Gay Blade, 1981. Saw it at the movie theater as a kid. I didn't understand all of the humor, but I understood some of it. And, watching it again, rewatching it, oh boy, it is politically incorrect. What a fun ride that movie is. We also have The Mask of Zorro from 1998. Starring the great actor Anthony Hopkins, who plays Don Diego Vega, and he also plays Zorro. But in this one, Zorro is not actually the true hero. It's actually Antonio Banderas, who is essentially training to be the next Zorro. He seeks revenge for the death of his brother, and he becomes great and skillful, like Zorro was, and And the movie's a lot of fun. It stars, also stars Catherine Zeta-Jones, who is just unbelievably beautiful in this film. Don Diego Vega searches for his long-lost daughter, that is, of course, is played by Catherine Zeta-Jones. And this is a good film. I give it 3 stars out of 4. It falls short of being great, but it is very good and a lot of fun. There was a sequel to it in 2005 that was a little less fun. It's a little long, and it not as good, but starred essentially the same cast, but just not nearly as fun to watch. And so we also have some other movies that I did not watch. I don't plan to watch them because there's way too many. But there are 3 Mexican Zorro films. Only 3, interesting. But there are 16 European Zorro films. And I just don't have it in me to watch all 16 films to do the research. So I will let you be the judges on that one. But what I am going to judge is my verdict, and we are going to talk with Tracy Gozell about this, and who she thinks the best Zorro is. I think I know her answer, considering she wrote a book about Douglas Fairbanks. But the verdict is Douglas Fairbanks is the best Zorro. And I really don't think it's close. Again, all the high-flying and, you know, flamboyant gestures just makes that movie so great. I love the look on Doug Fairbanks' face at certain points in this film. And I really have to admire all the stunts. Now, I don't know for a fact how many of the stunts were actually him and how many were not him. But he shows athleticism in this film. I think he probably, Douglas Fairbanks probably could have done a lot of things with that athletic body that he had. He was an amazing actor, and he makes it look easy. That's one thing I love about Doug Fairbanks is he makes everything look so easy, and it's not. but Tyrone Power, a great actor himself, he clocks in at number 2. I think Tyrone Power is a fine actor. I will even call him a great actor. He had some really great moments, even in this film. However, I like him a lot better in Blood and Sand, and I like Linda Darnell better in Blood and Sand too. Linda Darnell grew a lot in 1 year. She was 17 when she filmed Zorro in 1940. She was 17, very young lady. I think she showed more chops in Blood and Sand, and furthermore, I think Tyrone Power did too. I think Tyrone Power looked more on his game in Blood and Sand than he did on Zorro. I'm not saying he walked through it, but he just didn't look like he was having as much fun as Douglas Fairbanks was. So I give him the number 2, and I'd probably actually, you know, don't hate me, but I'd probably actually go with George Hamilton as the 3rd best. Even better than Antonio Banderas, which he actually didn't even play Zorro. He played the next Zorro, but so I don't even know if that even really counts. I probably go there. Now, if you're judging the leading ladies, I'd probably go I'd probably be inclined to say Catherine Zeta-Jones 1 and Linda Darnell 2, or you can flip-flop them. But again, Linda Darnell looked like she was a little inexperienced in that film compared to what she did a year later in Blood and Sand. It's really kind of amazing what kind of transformation there could be. But But that's my my verdict. And let's see what Tracy Gozel says. Okay, so we are with one of my favorite people in the whole world, Tracy Gozel. Tracy is a film historian. She is in charge of the Biograph Project, which is trying to restore every film from the early days of silent film, and of course she is also the author of The First King of Hollywood, all about Douglas Fairbanks. And Tracy, thank you so much for coming on here.
Oh, thank you for asking me. I always enjoy this.
Yes, it's fantastic to have you on, and of course your book, the First King of Hollywood, it's all about Doug. And first, tell me how you got into Douglas Fairbanks. We've talked about this before, but for the people that didn't listen 2 years ago, let's hear it here.
Well, I was about 13 years old, and I had found in my 8th grade library a sort of a book-like magazine called American Heritage Magazine, and there was an article in there by Richard Schickel about this fellow named Douglas Fairbanks. Uh-huh. And I had already read Lillian Gish's autobiography, and she was kind of my gateway drug to silent films, but I didn't know much about Doug, and this article so vividly brought him to life. In fact, Schickel later expanded it and turned it into a book called His Picture in the Papers. I think they've reissued it recently under another name. His daughter has done that. But I took that magazine home because, you know, you couldn't afford to Xerox. It was a nickel a page. Mm-hmm. And I retyped the entire article so that I would have it. And to this day, I worry that if I rephrased or said something that is paraphrasing Richard Schickel, I'm just so worried that it didn't come from me and it came from that memory of being 13 and typing out Richard Schickel's words. But then when I was in 10th grade, I got a moving 8mm projector for my birthday, and I started getting Douglas Fairbanks films, not even the swashbucklers, but the coat and tie comedies.
Yes.
Because the swashbucklers were longer, and that cost more to buy. So I fell in love with the character that was Douglas Fairbanks, and it turns out that there is a huge overlap between the screen image and who the man actually was, and that is certainly not always the case with Hollywood.
Yeah. No, and I've said before on this podcast, I've said, before Clark Gable, there was Douglas Fairbanks, and he really was the king of Hollywood. We have, I get so frustrated, but also sometimes I'm encouraged by some people. Because I've actually been able to turn on people to some silent films. I've done a couple podcasts on Clara Bow, and people started watching her films. I did a podcast, of course I did one with you. I've done two with you on Doug Fairbanks, but now I decided to do one on Zorro, and I'm going to get to a minute of why I've talked to you, which is, should be obvious to every listener, but maybe not. I want you, before we get into Zorro, please tell everybody what you're doing at the Biograph Project, because it's so important.
Oh, aren't you kind? I'm president of Film Preservation Society, and this is a nonprofit. We've been around since 2014, and our goal and mission is to protect, restore, preserve, and make sure people actually have access to otherwise lost or neglected silent films. So we started, even before we were fully incorporated as a 501c3, we worked through the San Francisco Silent Film Festival sort of as our charitable front.
And I need to hit that sometime, by the way.
Yeah, they're good people. We restored The Half-Breed and The Good Bad Man.
Yeah.
And believe it or not, I did that and funded that so that I could see good copies of the films to write about them in the book.
Yeah.
You know, we really did. We reconstructed The Half-Breed from different versions, including the Dawson City find. And we find even to this day, we're still occasionally pulling things from Dawson City. So we restored a number of Fairbankses now, and a number of them are available on Blu-ray, including the Three Musketeers. And we did that one because there is not, the only available versions for years were scratch 16 millimeter prints.
Yeah.
And if you see it in its tinted, pristine 35 millimeter glory with the Hans Schlegel coloring of the Yellow Horse, which is blows your mind.
Yeah.
You know, that was a coloring process that was just coming in a few DeMille films in the early 20s, and Fairbanks used it for comic effect. It's just a glorious thing. We also got the Montalto Orchestra to put together an entirely new score for it.
Uh-huh.
From classical works. And it's so great to see something like that with an orchestral score. And we've also restored and released Fairbanks' second film, Double Trouble. We got two reels of it out of Brazil, fortunately before the big fire blew up an archive down there. And the rest was from the Dawson City find. And we got, or excuse me, from Library of Congress remnants. That one was in Dawson City. And it was literally frame by frame in some instances, from this source versus that source, to get Doug just to trip and tumble down the stairs a little bit.
Uh-huh.
At one point took 40 cuts between different sources because the source material is so badly damaged. And it's not a great film. It's an okay film. It's a second film. He hasn't found his formula yet.
Mm-hmm.
So he plays a guy with split personality, and half the time he's a bad guy, which is kind of fun to see. And we put that thing back together, and all of these Blu-ray releases have on them Biograph films, because we are committed to restoring all 450 Biographs made between 1908, when D.W. Griffith mm-hmm. and cameraman Arthur Marvin made The Adventures of Dolly, through to the work of when Billy Bitzer joins the Griffith team, all the way through to 1913,
yeah.
Judith of Bethulia's made. And that's a 20-year project. We're about 5-6 years in.
Mm-hmm.
And we've got source material on an awful lot of those films, and we've finished a great number of them, including scoring them. Donald Sosin, the brilliant, wonderful Donald Sosin, is writing the and performing the musical scores for each. So there's a uniformity of style
mm-hmm.
across these releases. We are not doing, for example, rock and roll with them, which I know the Pickford Foundation is doing, and that's their choice. But we're trying to use music that was appropriate to the era.
Right.
And that somebody would hear. So later scores sometimes have more than one instrument, as would be the case in a thriving theater in 1912, 1913, mm-hmm. the original 1908, some nines. They simply have a single piano player. But of the Biographs, every single 1908 film is lost. And so we're recovering them by a modern way of scanning the paper prints.
Uh-huh.
You know, the last time they were sort of photographed was in the late 50s, and they look like they were filmed through Vaseline, you know, lens. It's you know, God bless the fellow who did it, but it with modern times we can do a better job. And
sure.
So we've obtained 20 of the 62, and we're going to do all of them, for which paper prints survive. For 1909, we got 55 of them in hand, but that was his busiest year. He made 143 that year, and so on. You know, we've got 21 of the 1910s, and he made 86. So we are getting there. This is not pie in the sky. It's a big deal. And if you go to Facebook and look for the page that's called The Biobrand
yes.
Project, you'll see the before and after stuff. Here's what it comes in and how jittery it looks, because, you know, the scanner will only focus on the sprockets and Biograph. The sprocket holes were pushed in as the camera was actually taking the film, so they were irregularly placed. And so then we digitally take it and focus on, you know, a fixed item within the frame and stabilize the image, and then we clean it up, and then we even know the rate at which bits are hand cranked the camera for each film.
Mm-hmm.
It's not 15 frames per second. Bits are tended to work at 14 to 15 frames per second, and in a one reeler that makes a difference of a minute and a half for how a film runs. So we're working with the correct speed, because we've got the production logs. We're backing up with as much original research as we possibly can. And when the 20 years is over, you know, maybe only 500 people on the planet will care about it, but I hope posterity will be happy.
I'm definitely one of them. And I before we start recording, the big dark secret of my podcast is that sometimes I talk about popular subjects just so people will get sucked in and listen to the lesser known subjects. And, you know, and I know sometimes, matter of fact, I recently did a podcast about Betty Compson,
obscure.
Yeah. And that was the most popular episode I've done for about 6 months. I'm not kidding.
Oh, wonderful.
I had so many downloads on that one, and I was absolutely amazing. And
he was
and,
one of the only people on those Henry Clive tins.
Yeah. Who, and
I'm not really familiar with her work. Everyone else,
I wasn't familiar either, but I got really familiar, and it got to a point where I think every night for about 3 weeks, I was searching for something Betty Compson on YouTube or whatever. And I was so happy to see some really, the amazing thing about Betty Compson, we're going off into another subject, but the amazing thing about her is she, unlike some of her, the people, you know, there, you know, like Mary Pickford and Clara Bow, they didn't really make it very deep into that pre-code era or beyond. And
oh, no.
you and I have talked about the movie Kiki. And I told you, I don't know if you remember, but I told you I don't hate Kiki. And you said, oh, no. I didn't say I love it. I said I didn't hate it.
I love
it.
Mary, but oh, my God.
I know. I just said I didn't hate it. I don't.
Yeah.
I never said I loved it.
Good for you.
Yeah.
You're a generous spirit.
Well, I'm going to be doing a podcast with a gentleman named Glenn Andrea in the future, probably in a few weeks. On the films of 1931, and that is going to be one of them that's included, only because it's like her swan song. It's her unfortunate swan song.
Well, there's, of course, always her last film.
What was it, Kiki last one? No, it wasn't?
No.
Oh, I thought it was. Which one was her last one?
Oh, my gosh, I'm suddenly blanking, and I should know. It was the one where she was the pioneer woman and
oh okay okay oh it's like one of those things where the release and, dates were kind of weird or whatever. Yeah,
you know, he cheats, but she sticks with him, and he becomes the great man. And Secrets
uh-huh.
was the name.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
he actually filmed it twice.
Yeah.
You know, redid it, trashed the first version.
Yeah.
That was Mickey Nealon, and then refilmed it.
But, well, I'm gonna say
it was practically her swan song.
Right, and it was unfortunate, obviously, but you know, the thing is that I want to say to my podcast audience, but also to you, Tracy, is that you should probably look for Glenn Andreev's films called Silent Emulsion, or not Silent Emulsion, Lost Emulsion. And Found Emulsion. He's got two films, documentaries, excellent documentaries. Lost Emulsion and Found Emulsion.
Are they streaming somewhere? Or
yeah, it's on Vimeo. And, you know, I think it's like $3 or something like that. He was very kind enough to let me see it for free. He sent me a free link to it. But I think it's like $3 or something. But I just really... I'm going to say particularly...
Does it deal with acting in silent films?
It has to do with finding silent films that were lost. It explains why films were lost. And, you know, which really is...
Sounds like someone I would like to know.
Yeah, Glenn is a director. He does a lot of small budget movies. He's been in the film business since 1985. And he is a historian. If you look on my podcast list, you'll see him on a lot of my, as my guest a lot of times. And anytime I just have to hit record and he'll, you know, let's talk about the Treasure of Sierra Madre. And he will just start talking.
Like pressing the button.
Yeah, exactly. I go get a drink and come back and he's still talking about the scene with, you know, like it's just great. But, and that's kind of similar to you. But we appreciate what you do with the Biograph Project. I just think it's fantastic. And, of course, we were talking about Mary Pickford a minute ago. Of course, she was married to Douglas Fairbanks at one time. And yeah. Let's bring it back to the subject of at hand, which is there were a lot of Zorro movies throughout the years. And we're talking about a period of really over 8 years of Zorro movies. And why? Now, you're biased. I'm probably biased.
Well, I'm not biased. I'm correct.
Yeah, you're correct. There you go. but why is Douglas Fairbanks the best Zorro?
Well, Fairbanks was the originator of the role. It had been a series in sort of a boys' adventure
uh-huh.
magazine, a serial called The Curse of Capistrano, and Mary Pickford actually was the one who read the story and recommended it to Doug. They were on their honeymoon, and on the way home on the train from New York to California, they'd done this European tour. And Doug was just not the kind of guy who did his homework, did a lot of reading. He was the kind of guy that...
She hated that too.
tell me the story. Mary, on the other hand, first child supporting her whole family, she not only did her homework, she did Doug's. So, you know, this material had been proposed to Fairbanks while he was in Europe from his team, and he trusted their judgment and optioned the story, the book, while he was still in Europe. So, on the way back to California from New York, Mary read the stories, and then she sort of told them to Doug. And urged him to read it, and he was stuck on a train, so he did. And so he not only read the original stories, but he added things to it that then were later added by the author to reprints of the original story. So the original Curse of Capistrano did not have Zorro carving the Z into, you know, the bad guy's bottom or face or whatever. Mm-hmm. That was the Fairbanks tweak, but it became so intertwined with everyone's concept of the character that when the individual chapters chapters of the Boys magazine were aggregated into a book. It was rewritten to include those things. And what's almost impossible to find, and I beg if any of your readers are out there, is the original version from the All Boys Weekly, or whatever it was, of The Curse of Capistrano. I've gone all the way to the Library of Congress to try and get the original. The little magazines managed to walk out of the Library of Congress back probably in the 1950s underneath somebody's shirt. And so it's not even there. And anytime you go on a book search for it, the earliest you can get is sort of, again, the published assembled book from the stories and not the original. But the narrative at the time was that Fairbanks added this. And so he shaped Zorro in many ways, apart from adding the Z carving. He gave his own silly twist to Don Diego. You know, I state in my book that Don Diego isn't so much Faye as he is just gently sleepy. I mean, he just yawns and he sleeps and he shows tricks with his shadows and with his little handkerchief. You know, have you seen this one? Have you seen this one? But in fact, Fairbanks was a lover of magic tricks. And if you go back even to Mr. Fix-It, which is one of the films we saved with the strong assist of the George Eastman Museum, who was given the only known copy, the Italian print of the film back in the day, and then we funded the translation of the titles and then got it released on Blu-ray for people. Fairbanks sits next to a bored and distressed woman who doesn't want to marry him, but her father's making him marry her, and she's desperately in love with someone else, and he's trying to cheer her up, and he pulls out a thing, a handkerchief, and says, have you seen this one?
Yes.
So he was doing that 3-4 years before, 2 to 3 years before the Mark of Zorro. So he put his stamp on both the heroic Zorro figure and on the comic foil, the alter ego Don Diego.
Yeah. Yeah, I when I watched, I think I told you before we started recording that I was fortunate enough to view a showing at the oldest movie theater in America, by the way, in Ottawa, Kansas, which is I forget the name of the movie theater, but it's the oldest movie theater in Kansas, or not Kansas, but in the United States.
And what year was it?
I want to say it was 1908 or 1905 or.
Oh, how splendid!
Yeah, it's just absolutely, it was just marvelous to watch Douglas Fairbanks and the Mark of Zorro, in this theater, and I viewed a Stan Laurel short before that, and which was hilarious, but the watching. Doug on the big screen is so different than just, you know, watching a DVD or watching watching it on YouTube or something. It's just
Leonard Maltin told me a story, and it's one that warms me to the cockles of my heart. A number of years ago,
another one of my favorite people, by the way,
San Francisco Silent Film Festival showed The Mark of Zorro. And even I thought, oh my God, everybody's seen that a million times. Can't you show something a little more rare? But, you know, hey, they were showing it. I was there. I was on board. I was probably introducing it. I can't remember. And Leonard Maltin wrote later that he said to himself, oh my God, the Mark of Zorro, I've seen it a million times. So he went out to lunch during that session. But he came back early. And he said, walking into that theater, and seeing the audience react with the action and the comedy and just, you know, cheering, suddenly he was seeing and feeling the film in a different way
yep.
than he had ever felt it before. And both he and I, you know, learned our lessons, and that just because we narrow sort of sated, overburned out film scholars say we've seen this so many times, doesn't remove from the film its essential strength and virtues that gets everybody else absolutely enchanted. And I can't recommend the film highly enough. The silent Marco Zorro and Chaplin's the Kid are very good introductory yeah. films to somebody to whom you're trying to get into silent films. It's like, no, these aren't run too fast. They're not, you know, rinky-tink stereotypes. These are marvelous, funny, heart-wrenching stories. And, you know, when I showed The Kid to some film students in Maryland at Towson University, which was the University of Maryland's only branch that had a media department, and it was a good solid one. I mean, a lot of people who work in production came out of there. So I said, okay, you know, I'm going to show you The Kid, and, you know, if you don't cry, you don't have a heart. And I ran the film, and when it was over, you know, nobody cried. Oh, no, we're young, cynical people. And a little while afterwards, one of the students came up to me and said, I was crying.
Yes. How can you not cry?
They didn't want to admit it.
Yeah, how can you not cry? It's like in the movie Stripes with Bill Murray, where he says, how many of you cried when you saw Old Yeller? And nobody raised their hand. He said, yeah, nobody cried when you saw Old Yeller. And they're all like, yeah, okay, yeah, I cried.
Okay, yeah, of course. If you don't cry, you don't have a heart.
Yeah.
And by the end of the semester, when I asked them their favorite film, and I'd shown them, you know, Zorro and, of course, The Birds and all kinds of films, I was enchanted that they picked Mary Pickford's Poor Little Rich Girl, because they gave themselves over to that with the fantasy, the dream sequence, the morphine sequence,
yeah.
essentially, with all the animals and stuff, the same way a four-year-old kid would see The Wizard of Oz for the first time, with no irony, with just a pure heart.
Oh, yeah.
The way that audiences in 1920 saw these films. They yeah. weren't too cool for school. They were there to really absorb and enjoy the story. And most of us should still be that way today, but I know for sure we all were when we were four and sitting on our mother's lap and seeing The Wizard of Oz for the first time. You know, those flying monkeys, I was no longer in Pennsylvania on my mother's lap. My God, I was there in the monkey herd. Going to get Dorothy, and
pretty scary.
Good filmmaking.
Yeah.
And so when you see the Marco Zorro on a big screen, you know, by the time he reveals himself, and he does in this film,
yeah.
it's, you know, it's not an ongoing mystery series. By the last reel, he has told the world Don Diego is Zorro.
Yeah.
And that's also so darn gratifying. You know, I always want Superman to just say, okay, you know, I'm Clark Kent, as if that fools anybody. The big hunk just puts on glasses and suddenly nobody sees him. But the concept of Batman was derived by the young teenager who drew him for the comics, literally from the Marco Zorro with the dual identity and the Batcave. You'll remember in Fairbanks' Zorro, he rides his horse in, he goes into a cellar, the leaf cover.
That's true, yeah.
Opens and closes. He, you know, he'll peek through a clock to look into the house, but he's in this other place. And the young man who created Batman had never seen Scarlet Pimpernel. So this was the first time he had been exposed to the guy pretending to be a fey weakling by day and is, you know, a major hero by night, dual identity. And
Yeah, I as a matter of fact, when I was developing the concept for this episode, I thought about that. And I thought, you know, Zorro's kind of a superhero. It's kind of like Batman, not really like superpowers, but he's got, you know, skills. And
Batman doesn't have superpowers.
No,
Batman,
he's got skills. That's it.
He's got a utility belt. Well, yeah. Both of them wear capes.
Yeah.
And both wear a mask. And the stance that you see, Batman and Superman, the knuckles on the hips, the elbows out, the feet apart, that stance is the Fairbanks stance.
Oh, I love that you just said that. That's so true.
The comic book artists, these young men, based both Batman and Superman on Fairbanks. However, Bruce Wayne was based on Harold Lloyd. Oh, excuse me, Clark Kent was based on Harold Lloyd.
Yeah, that's some information I didn't know, but now I'm thinking about it. Wow. Yeah, I've had Suzanne Lloyd on here twice. She and I talked a lot about her. You probably know her, don't you?
Yes, I do. I just had a lovely long conversation with her today on the phone.
Today? Oh, wow.
And we share the same veterinarian.
I adore that woman. She's just fabulous. And her passion for Harold Lloyd is very similar to yours.
By her grandfather.
Oh.
He was the father to her. Mildred was.
Yes. And for people that didn't listen, she told me that she was 16 years old before she realized who he even was, you know. Yeah. And I think that's just absolutely incredible.
Just her dad. I mean, she grew up in extraordinary privilege. If you're raised at Green Acres, you must think the world is all candy and lollipops. And you go to Westlake School for Girls, and I mean, it's just. It's a rarefied environment, but she emerged out of it a real person, whereas a lot of people would come out of that as just entitled, obnoxious brats.
Yeah.
Which a lot
no, of you're right. Were. I've and talked to a couple of them like that.
Burned down the house. It was just literally burned down his house one time. There was a lot of troubled children of Hollywood stars.
Yeah. You're absolutely right. I think I've had a couple of conversations with people that were a lot less grateful than she is, let's just say. Mm-hmm. But just absolutely lovely woman. It's so fascinating that you just talked to her today. So let's compare, do some comparisons. Now, have you seen all the other Zorro,
I've seen Tyrone Power.
Yeah, what do you think of Tyrone Power?
I've gotten to see the Guy Williams, although I know people have affection for it, especially Disney.
They do, they do.
I saw the Antonio Banderas Mask of Zorro, and may I say the stuntmen did remarkable work.
Yeah.
You know, the business of standing between two horses and riding, which John Ford used to do and have, he was proud whenever his young actors could do that. That was not Banderas. You know, you've got a guy in a mask, you just get somebody of the same build. If you are not doing your own stunts, if you didn't design the stunts, as far as I'm concerned, you're not Zorro. Although Tyrone Power is very pretty.
Yeah, I see, my thing about Tyrone Power is that I watched it, believe it or not, I literally watched his version for the first time last week, for the very first time. I've seen.
What did you think?
I liked him a lot better in
Blood and Sand.
What's that?
Blood and Sand.
Yes. Yeah. And which was also a remake of a silent film. He was so much better in that. He looked like he had his heart in that. And in Zorro, I'm not saying he just walked through it, but he didn't look at all, you know, enthusiastic to the same level as Doug was. And of course, Doug had this ability. We used to, I live in Kansas City. We used to have this player named, his name was Amos Otis
on the Kansas City Royals. And there were a lot of people that were down on him early in his career because they said he just dogged it in the outfield, but he wasn't dogging it. It just came easy to him. And that's what Doug, like one of the things that Mary Pickford got really upset with Doug about when they made the shrew. Yeah. Yeah. She got mad because he didn't learn his lines and all this stuff. And he just went out and nailed it anyway, you know. It's like
he read it off a chalkboard.
He was just as good as she was.
Quote where he acknowledges that he read it off a chalkboard, and whenever they had a great big dog in the film, just a huge Great Dane kind of thing.
Yeah.
And every so often the dog would wander in front of the chalkboard, and he'd be in trouble. And you know, my heart goes out to Mary because she was somebody, again, who showed up early and stayed late and worked incredibly hard. And Doug was somebody who, let's take the afternoon off and play a stunt on the, you know, screenwriter, speaking. And he kept a loosey-goosey happy set. And indeed, he got glowing reviews for his performance and for Mary, who, if you turn off the sound, is brilliant. I mean, you watch her in that scene.
Oh, yeah.
Cold in the rain. And just turn off the sound, and you're seeing an actress who was born to communicate with us through silence. Doug did make it look easy, but when it came to the stunts themselves, they were carefully worked out and carefully rehearsed multiple times, exactly so it could look easy.
Yeah.
You know, Alan Dwan, who did not direct Zorro, but who directed Robin Hood and several other Fairbanks films, said that he could jump much farther than they would show him jumping, but they wanted to make it look like dance so gracefully, like he was practically floating, not that he was straining to get that last extra foot out of the jump. And to make something look that easy takes a tremendous amount of work, and he put in that work, but also just the non-action scenes, he just had this natural gift and charm. But the way to recognize how hard Fairbanks worked is to watch a string of outtakes. They exist at the George Eastman Museum for Robin Hood. They have been produced online, or not online, but I believe there are a number with one of the released versions of the Iron Mask. You'll see take after take of him doing the same thing, and them expanding the stunt or tweaking it. Robin Hood, for example, there's a scene that we see, and I mentioned this in the book, where he takes his bow, as in bow and arrow, and scoops up one of the poor hapless characters. It happened to be Charlie Stevens, who was in all of his films, and hangs him up by a hook that's sticking out, and then just runs on. It's like a whoop, whoop, up he goes, and this guy's left hanging and looking like an idiot.
I know what you're talking about, yeah.
It sounds easy and fun, except he's lifting a full-grown man, looking at him, and having to make that motion quickly. And if you watch the outtakes over and over, he lifts and hooks, and he gets it done, but it doesn't look effortless.
Yeah,
and you have to make it look effortless. And in the end, they did it. They did break it into two shots, and maybe that's the only way they could do it. But the work to try and get that twinkle, and it's gone in the blink of an eye. And you wonder how many other jumps and leaps, through that window from that tree, you know, swinging underhand. Feet first, belly up, instead of head first, how many times you had to try to get that and not even, hit the side of the window. In fact, he badly injured himself while filming The Nut.
Yeah.
Where he's getting married, he's at the court, he and the heroine are there, and he's facing the judge, and there's the window, and out the window he sees the bad guy, and he says, "Excuse me, Your Honor," and goes out the window. The bad guy has meanwhile moved on, and a new fellow has stepped in, so he tackles an innocent citizen. But in one of those jumps, he caught his foot. And, you know, that's an injury. And you land on an outstretched hand, that's an injury. And so if you see him backstage doing publicity shots, you know, with a crowd of, you know, sailors has come to town. Doug, we've got to go greet them at the studio. Hello. And you'll see him, and you'll see he's holding his arm up on someone's shoulder, and he's not bearing weight on one foot. And he's wearing the outfit that he wore when he jumped through that window and injured himself. He broke more bones and strained more things. So that he made it look easy, but unlike Jackie Chan, who, God bless him, is phenomenal stunt character, actor. At the end of his films, he'll actually show us all the times it goes bad.
Oh, yeah.
If he jumps and breaks his ankle, you know, we'll remember seeing the scene, but they'll show
The
outtake, him jumping and breaking his ankle. And Doug never, you never saw the outtakes. You never saw him hurt. No matter what he broke, they didn't show that film.
Yeah, you see, for me, when I compare Doug's version of Zorro to Tyrone Power, it's kind of like, you know, you have your favorite pizza place. And let's just say you have the pizza and you're like, oh, this is great pizza. This is wonderful pizza. And then they make a frozen version of their pizza. And then you make it and you're at home and you're like, hey, this is pretty good, but it's just not as good as it was at the restaurant. You know?
Yeah, it's sort of the same. I mean, the mushroom and green peppers are there.
Yeah.
Why isn't it the same?
Yeah.
Who had never seen the silent version, and that was their first introduction to Zorro, I'm sure they loved the Mark Zorro.
Yeah.
But wasn't the sensation that it was in 1920. And this was December of 1920 when it came out, so... if I could ever meet Martin Scorsese, I'd tell him that the opening episode of what was his Atlantic City, Boardwalk Empire.
Yeah.
The floozy is saying to our anti-hero, well, you know, you want to grow a mustache like Doug Fairbanks, and he's going to be Zorro. Doug didn't have a mustache until he filmed The Three Musketeers.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
He's done one for Zorro, and we watch him take it off. He wasn't associated with a mustache, and he hadn't even thought to make Marco Zorro till the summer of 1920. So I'm like, damn it, doesn't anybody ever check the facts? Although I have to tell you, I just started watching a new series, or it's not necessarily new, but it's new to me, called For All Mankind. And it's an alternative future. It starts at that moment in 1969. When it's 3 weeks shy of Neil Armstrong landing on the moon.
Uh-huh.
Then the Russians get there first, and this changes the entire American space plan.
Yes,
plan and funding and all sorts of different things happen. But I've been watching it pretty carefully, and I have yet to find a mistake.
Uh-huh.
Whoever, because I, you're younger, I suspect, but I remember Kennedy being assassinated, and watching Lee Harvey Oswald and watching the funeral. So Neil Armstrong landing on the moon the same week as Teddy Kennedy and Chappaquiddick, you know, that's all. I was watching TV at that time and remembering what I was watching in this alternate future. You know, Teddy Kennedy cancels his planned trip to Chappaquiddick because of, you know, the Russians getting on the moon first, and mm-hmm. go back to get this Senate testimony, and you're going, oh, wow, there's a little tweak in history. So some people really get it right and some don't. I wandered far afield with the Marco Zorro there. Forgive me.
Yeah, and then when I also go to, say, the Guy Williams Disney one, I actually like Henry Calvin better than in the movie, in those movies. Henry Calvin is quite funny. But
what did he play? Was he Sergeant?
He was like the Oliver Hardy-ish guy, you know.
Yeah, Sergeant
yeah.
Gunzel.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Noah Beery played the part in the original. Zorro.
Yeah, yeah. He and that one little skinny guy.
They were in.
They were Babes in Toyland, yeah. And they were almost the only redeeming things in that movie too. That movie, my mom will get mad at me for saying this, but that movie just stunk. Babes in Toyland was just almost.
It was a series, I think, on television first.
Oh, was it? Oh, I didn't even know that.
The Disney adults will tell us.
Yeah.
I am not a Disney adult. I just stopped after. Yeah, probably around the time Bambi's mom died, but you know, I just
well, Snow White is still the best animated feature, I think.
It's marvelous, if you don't mind. It's now horribly politically incorrect, you know.
Can't get away from this stuff, right?
You can't watch sections of Fantasia. I mean, they have to cut them out because they're so like, oh dear, no. and that's the truth of most things, but I have to admit, Marco Zorro has aged brilliantly.
Extraordinarily well, yeah.
No ethnic group, none. Fairbanks represents, you know, a person of Hispanic heritage who's there to protect the downtrodden Mexican peasants from the greedy, licentious governor, and this is like around 1840 in California, and it insults nobody. It pleases everybody, and if somebody jumps into a haystack from a roof, you know it's Fairbanks jumping.
Uh-huh.
He has a kyphosis on his neck that is, to me, as a clinician, very distinctive, and I can tell when it's done, just based on that anatomical anomaly. So yes, that is Fairbanks going down the sail in The Black Pirate, just no doubt about it. And so it's hard to beat when your leading man is also the producer, is also the originator of the character,
yeah,
after the author creates him and builds upon that and builds something richer and funnier and deeper. You know, Fairbanks' D'Artagnan is not Dumas' D'Artagnan, because Dumas was writing a sexually far more sophisticated book,
mm-hmm,
because The Three Musketeers in many ways is not a children's book. You know, there's sex in there, and even the heroine is his landlord's wife, not his landlord's
niece, yeah, yes, yes.
Which gets changed in the Fairbanks version because he knew what those censors were capable of, and he did a brilliant job in still providing entertainment.
That's true. Now, you were going back to the political correctness. Then we go to Zorro the Gay Blade.
Oh, God, I thought that was very funny when I saw it. Now, I saw it so many years ago when it first came out.
Came out 81, yeah.
All my gay friends hate it or they love it. I don't know.
Yeah, there's just no reason to hate it. It's so funny. It's it's adorable. And it's just... And, you know, it's just a fun movie. And I think in some ways it's like a tribute. Some ways it's a parody. But I think ultimately it's out of fondness. I watched that movie.
The only George Hamilton movie I've ever liked.
Oh, is that right? Yeah, I saw that when I was 10 at the movie theater. So that tells you how old I am.
Make me feel old.
Yeah, sorry. But I was, I saw it at the movie theater when I was 10. And matter of fact, I just talked with I don't know if you've ever heard of Michael Elias.
No, I don't know him.
Yeah, he wrote the screenplay to The Jerk, and also to The Frisco Kid, which came out in 1979. And I told him the same thing. I said, I was 8 years old and I watched The Frisco Kid, you know, and my mom and dad didn't let me see The Jerk at the movie theater because it was rated R. But I did get to see it later, which it's like the most ridiculous R rating of all time.
Yeah.
It is not an R rated film. Like, what is in that film that makes it R? I don't get it. Like, somebody was in a bad mood.
Obscenities.
Yeah, it's like, yeah, okay.
Yeah, it was 1981. Zorro the Beyblade was 1981.
Yeah. Of course,
You're an infant, my friend.
Yeah. Well, I don't feel that way.
Well, and also you would enjoy silent films. So
you know, I don't feel that. Yeah, I do enjoy silent films.
How many episodes of your podcast have you had?
I have done 200, approximately 230. This will be 230.
Wow.
Yeah. I did my 200th the one.
What are you on?
I'm on almost everything. I'm on Spotify and on, well, pretty much anything that's anything that's podcast related. I've had trouble getting on Apple, and I don't know why. I keep trying to get on Apple, and for some reason they just keep rejecting it. I think that it's taken away some possible subscribers, but I have people in Poland that listen to me regularly, and people that live 10 minutes from me. I have no idea who they are, but
please tell them to go to www.filmpreservationsociety.org.
Mm-hmm.
It's a .org, not a .com. You have to write out the whole word. You can click, when you're in there, you can click on shop and get a signed book with a film. But also, you can just click and watch the little videos of, you know, us at the laboratory. Serge Bromberg, who I don't know if you know, but he would be a marvelous subject. He runs Lobster Films in Paris. And they acquired the whole Black Hawk collection.
Uh-huh.
He and David Shepard back when Black Hawk sold off all their assets. And he also has all the European rights, I believe. Maybe it's only France, but I believe it's all of Europe, to all the RKO films.
Uh-huh.
So he's just restored the Irene Dunne, Charles Boyer love story. And, you know, they've got King Kong for Europe.
Yeah.
And he's just a phenomenal guy. Well, he set up a laboratory in Burbank, as well as his laboratory in Europe. And they do our scanning work and, you know, just the technical work on a 10K scanner. And there's a little mini documentary just about that. And so, to your friends in Poland or your friends 10 minutes away, please come check us out, because, man, sometimes you just feel like you're all alone on an island. You put out a newsletter every month, and Kevin Brownlow writes the essay.
One of the better champions of the world, yeah.
Oh, my God, and it's stuff people haven't read.
Yeah.
So you're getting, it's like you're getting a new chapter of the parades gone by every month.
Yeah.
You're like, here's my interview with Ole Cow.
Well, Tracy,
and, so, you know, once a month kind of people pick up their heads and look us up because of Kevin, but your podcast could be very helpful.
Well, I want to say that there's hope, though, Tracy, because I told you about a Betty Compson episode. I did an episode on Grand Hotel, which is not a silent film, but but it's obviously a classic.
No, it's the first of the multi-star films.
Yeah. And
at Dinner at Eight.
But I did that with a couple of 20-something young ladies, and they were very enthusiastic, and it just made my heart so warm. Like, oh my gosh, oh.
Who did they warm up to more, Joan Crawford or?
It's funny. Oh. Yeah, the one I talked with was a Joan girl, you know, and I honestly, I've always been one of those people that champions the person that doesn't get as much attention. I'm a Joan guy, you know, I like if, cause everybody, you know,
was kind of moping for the whole movie.
Yeah, but it's no, it's true. Yeah, it I really like. I mean, Greta Garbo made my number two on the top 10 leading ladies of all time. And oh, that one I mentioned.
Number what?
Greta Garbo was number two on my
leading. Number one.
Number one was Vivian Leigh. And it's
really?
I did it on a point system, and okay. It was the only thing about Vivian Leigh that she scored low on was amount of her IMDb list is fairly short compared to
two major films.
Yeah, compared to, but it just she's so striking and so on point with her performances that I just how it ended up. And
that was controversial.
No, it actually wasn't. What was I rated Joan and Betty Davis actually tied and on my point system, and I put Joan ahead as a tiebreaker just because I'm making the rules. I'm doing it. It's my list. I'm gonna do it. So and that
Betty
did
would have come into your house and said, "What to dump?"
Betty gets all the positive attention and Joan gets most of the negative attention. So, Joan couldn't get out of her own way sometimes. I get it, but I still.
Did Mary Pickford make the list, I hope?
Mary Pickford was up. She did not make the list. She was very close. If I remember right, Vivian Leigh, Greta Garbo, it was Joan Crawford, Betty Davis, Katharine Hepburn. Nine of them are dead. Meryl Streep made the list, and she's the only living one. Let's see, who else did it? Jean Harlow, and that was a tough one. Because it's like but where Jean Harlow scores high is. She eats up that screen and she just absolutely captivates. But so did Mary Pickford, and I get it.
Pickford was an international.
I'm punching myself right now.
Industry.
Yeah, the thing is, yeah, she was very close. But I had Doug number six because he really. I don't think Mary Pickford was. There was ever a time where you could say she was the queen of the box office. Maybe in 1910.
1914.
Yeah, maybe then. Yeah, maybe.
And contracts today, Hollywood contracts today, are built on the model of what she negotiated in 1960.
Yeah, it's true. You're right about that.
So she's, and you say she co-formed United Artists, a major distribution firm. She was a staggeringly important figure beyond her.
She sure was, yeah.
Public persona and appearance. But. Such lists are individual, and that's okay. I mean, did you have Charlie Chaplin or Buster Keaton?
No, not as leading men, because they.
Okay.
And now, if I were going to talk about
that wasn't the stars. It was
that. Yeah, it was. It had to do with the best leading man and who captivates that screen and who sells tickets.
I hear you.
And John Wayne sells tickets. And Doug Fairbanks
sold tickets. And John Wayne have to be.
Yeah. John Wayne, I think with John Wayne was five or four.
Who's number two after Bogart?
It was Bogart. Boy, I did this 2 years ago, and now I'm struggling remembering exactly. I had Bogart, and Harrison Ford was not number two. I think he was number three because
he was big.
Yeah, he was big. Yeah. He was the Doug Fairbanks of his time, which he's still around. But yeah, he's going to do another Indiana Jones movie. Supposedly. I would say they're fairly similar, except if I were going to talk to somebody, I would a lot rather talk to Doug, because Harrison Ford's kind of a bore,
He's supposed to be actually the backstage gossip is that he's a very nice man in real life. He always seemed grumpy. I mean, I would never approach him. I would be afraid that he would,
Yeah, I think he's just a bore of an interview. Yeah, he just doesn't like being interviewed.
That's the persona error. But apparently, behind the scenes, he's a lovely and gracious.
Well, Michael Elias, the guy that I just interviewed a few weeks ago, this podcast that we're doing, this is actually going to publish before that one is. When I talked about him with the Frisco Kid, let's just say he didn't have any kind words to say about Gene Wilder at all, but he did like Harrison Ford a lot. And he said Harrison, but I think Harrison Ford was too young and not as experienced enough to say, oh, we're going to do it this way. And Gene Wilder supposedly just took control of the set and had a veteran actor. And I said on that, I have to tell you something. Gene Wilder, when I was a little kid, was my absolute favorite actor. Between Willy Wonka, Silver Streak, Stir Crazy, he made
Young Frankenstein.
Yeah, Young Frankenstein, of course. He was just king. He was just king of comedy and of film comedy of his time.
I always feel sad when I think of him.
I cried when he died. He was a part of me.
His wife, Gilda Radner, and she had a terrible death of ovarian cancer, and she was this light, bright, this figure of love and youth and kind of ebullience and giggly generosity, and she suffered so, and he suffered because she suffered, and I can't remember the circumstances of his passing, but I think he also had perhaps a slow lingering.
Yeah, he sure did. He did. Yeah,
if they were crabby in their regular lives, I don't know, but there's some people I grieve for. I don't grieve as much for, say, Michael Jackson, because I believe those little boys. You know, I think he was troubled and abused, but then turned it around and nobody sued me, but I suspect he did sexually abuse.
Well, in the case of Gene Wilder, when I was interviewing Michael Elias, he said what Gene did was he took a movie that was supposed to be more of a serious movie and made it into a comedic western, and it was supposed to be about
like Blazing Saddles,
and he tried to make it a comedy as much as possible, and so then what ended up happening is people like Roger Ebert looked at it and said, is this a comedy or a western or a drama or what is this? I don't get it. Michael Aldridge, the director, kind of got bullied by a veteran director got bullied. And I said, and I did say to him, I said, what, can you imagine Jack Lemmon telling Billy Wilder, we're going to do it this way. that wouldn't have happened.
Well, it depends on how powerful the star is at the time.
Yeah, it's really been since the 70s that these...
In 1982, when you were 11, I moved to Chicago. I was a physician, and I was sitting in a restaurant in Chicago, like maybe my first week there, and there at the next table, heading up a group of people, was Roger Ebert. And I knew I hit the big time. I was sitting in the same restaurant as Roger Ebert, and he also had a terrible demise, but he was courageous and wonderful, and his wife was tremendously supportive. Credit to both of them. We've now again wandered far afield, but I love Zorro the Gay Blade and Antonio Banderas, and all of those versions are like sorry, those are modern.
Well, when I watch the Antonio Banderas one, I really actually, it's harder to take my eyes off of Catherine Zeta-Jones, to be honest.
Oh, she's so beautiful.
And it's the same way with Linda Darnell with Tyrone Power, I think that when he did Blood and Sand, if I'm not mistaken.
Rita Hayworth.
This was the year before. He did it the year before Zorro, right? I think.
You're talking talkies. I'm sorry.
41. out of your realm. I want to say 41. He did.
It's enough to know that he was at Fox.
Actually, Zorro was first, and Linda, because Linda Darnell was 17 when she filmed that, and
wow.
Yeah.
Marguerite DeLamotte was. a spring chicken. And you look at some of the Fairbanks' co-stars. He co-starred with a young woman, and they were meant to be not, you know, interchangeable and not to overshadow him. But I'm suddenly blanking on her name, but she played the second lead in Rebecca of Sunnybrook Farm with Mary Pickford. And she was, you know, all of 15 at that time.
Yeah.
So when she's co-starring with Fairbanks, a year later, she's 16.
Yeah.
And that was not considered inappropriate. I mean, you know, girls just, were marrying at 16.
Just a different time. It really.
16.
Yeah.
And, but you watch her a couple of years or just a year before, and she is, you know, a 15-year-old playing a 13-year-old very convincingly because she is a kid.
Yeah.
And, you know, those young people grew up fast. And,
yeah.
But of course, they died early. I mean, Fairbanks died at 56.
Yes.
You did your living in your teens and 20s.
Yeah. And Tyrone Power died early, young, and Linda Darnell died young.
He had a heart attack.
Yeah.
I think he was filming a scene with Basil Rathbone, wasn't he? A fencing scene?
Yeah, yeah.
Had a heart attack. Rathbone was the best fencer in Hollywood, and that includes Fairbanks. He was better than Doug. Technically, he was just, because Fairbanks would bring in, I think it was Verterhoven or some major fencing champion, and would train them for these scenes, so that when you see a sword fight in almost any modern film, you'll only see like two or three exchanges of blades before they cut, because the actors learn this sequence, they cut, they don't want people to get hurt.
Yeah.
When you see something with Fairbanks or with Basil Rathbone, you see long extended sword fighting sequences, and they're marvelous. And the funny thing is, have you ever seen the Ronald Coleman version of Prisoner of Zenda with Fairbanks Jr.?
Yeah.
There is a scene where Ronald Coleman is fighting, I think he's fighting Doug Jr. And, you know, fighting any way he can, and Coleman throws a chair at him, which is a Fairbanks move. Only Fairbanks started by, you know, throwing furniture and doing all kinds of tricks in the midst of a sword fight. And they have the villain, who was Fairbanks Jr., said, "Who throws furniture?" And of course, that was an homage to his father.
That's awesome.
Senior. And so there was an inside joke in Hollywood. And, you know, when they remade the thing, they remade it shot for shot with Stuart Granger in color about 20 years later. And had Stephen Lasker's mother, the wonderful film noir actress. Oh, that snoring is my dog, by the way. I apologize.
I thought I was boring you.
Play the Mary Astor part. She was in Out of the Whatever with Robert Mitchum. I'm blanking on her name. Anyway,
I am too.
I'm sure that line is in there because they replicated it shot for shot and kept the dialogue. The direction was, honestly, I'm not keeping the drunk. I'm generous to hobos, but there's no great need for me to have one in my office. But anyway, besides going to filmpreservationsociety.org, watch The Prisoner of Zenda.
Yeah.
And you will see that Doug continued to influence Hollywood. He also convinced his son to take the villain role in that film. He said, "Are you kidding? That role is so easy and so wonderful that Lassie, or no, excuse me, Rin Tin Tin could do it. Lassie wasn't a thing yet." Often they re-quote it later saying Lassie. But and if you think about it, in the silent version, Louis Stone played the hero, And who played the villain? Ramon Navarro.
Uh-huh.
And Ramon Navarro moved up to stardom. And Doug Jr., who'd been in a lot of programmers but hadn't had a big breakout film such as the one where they're all in India with Cary Grant and Victor McLaughlin, directed by George Stevens. We know the film. We just can't remember.
Yeah, I know. I always blank out when I do the...
Gunga Din.
Yeah.
But the reason he got something like Gunga Din is because he had that fabulous role as the bad guy in The Prisoner of Zenda.
Yeah.
And, you know, ditto, James Mason had it in the Stuart Granger version. If you play the bad guy in The Prisoner of Zenda, you're going on to stardom. That's the sexy role.
And before we started recording, this has nothing to do with Zorro also, but before we started recording, we were mentioning William Powell being a villain.
Then
When Nighthead Was in Flower, starring Marion Davies, and toward the end of the film, you see him in a duel, and it's just, I think it's fabulous to watch William Powell in a villain role.
Yeah, in tights. Well, he was in Romola, leading Dorothy Gish. He was the bad guy. And,
yeah.
You know, if you want to see a great, rarely seen William Powell villain part, one of our restorations is a film called Too Many Kisses. It was a Richard Dix film with William Powell as the villain, and you say, well, why restore a Richard Dix comedy from 1925? You're doing biographs, you're doing Doug Fairbanks. We're hoping to, you know, restore some other major films that have been neglected. And the reason is Harpo Marx had his first film appearance in a silent film.
Oh, that's true.
As Harpo.
Yeah.
You know, he's got the wig and because he'd been appearing on Broadway at that time. And so most people are buying that film, which is a fundraiser for Film Preservation Society. Most people are buying that film because Harpo Marx is in it, and mm-hmm. he's otherwise, you know, the earliest appearance. He's so young and he's so funny. But any William Powell fan should also contemplate buying it because he's a brilliant bad guy. He's more interesting to watch often than the hero. And Richard Dix is a pretty charming hero.
Yeah, it's William Powell, one of the, I'm not going to say, he's not unsung, but he just, he's
underappreciated.
Yeah, yeah. And
really undersung.
Yeah.
When they should be singing aloud.
Yeah, and before we started recording, I also mentioned that, you know, I just live 20 minutes from where William Powell and Gene Harlow lived, which is just amazing. You go, there's a restaurant called the Majestic Steakhouse in downtown Kansas City, Missouri. They have a mural of famous Kansas Cityans, and you see Gene Harlow and William Powell on that mural, and it's amazing to watch. And yeah, he just lived go down the road about 20 minutes.
Famous Kansans were there.
Disney was from Marceline, Missouri, which, and then he moved to Kansas City with his family. What's that?
They're claiming him, even though he lived in
Kansas City from I think age 12 to about age 22.
Chicago.
Yeah, yeah. Then he supposedly developed the Mickey Mouse character here, but it wasn't called Mickey Mouse at the time. And I'm blanking on what.
No, he was doing the Alice comedies. M.I. Works was the fellow who, again, I'm not a Disney adult, and all my friends who are Disney adults will come in and say, no, the original sketches were first in 1926. And it's, if you want to see this, go to the Disney Family Museum in San Francisco. It is brilliantly designed. It is full of stuff you wouldn't believe. So you'll see the first little scrap of paper on which they're drawing the mouse. And it's preserved. And you start going through a timeline. So you're with Walt when he's young. And you follow it all the way through. You come out at the end. And there's a huge layout of Disneyland as it first appeared. And I've only been to Disneyland once in my life. I never was taken there as a child. It wasn't the sort of thing that was in our wheelhouse as a family. You know, most people, you go to Disneyland, but we...
Yeah, my mom grew up 15 minutes from there and never went.
Well, I've yet to go to the Getty Museum, and that's a shameful thing to admit. But I did when my kids were like 3 and 5, do one afternoon there, and the younger one spiked a fever, so I took him back to the hotel and stayed with him while my husband and my oldest rode all the different rides. But it was very clean and very nice and lovely. But we were back to famous Kansas, who besides Walt?
Let's see, there were oh gosh, who else is on there?
George Brett? Did he come from?
No, he can't. He came from Southern California, then he went to Kansas City, and he still lives in Kansas City. But I'm trying to remember. Those are the three big ones. Count Basie.
Oh, that's huge.
Yeah, that's a big one. Yeah, yeah. You know, I still one of my favorite scenes in a comedy is Blazing Saddles, where here comes the new sheriff coming by, and Count Basie's like, "All right, it's so great. It's just what a fabulous."
I like when they had to go back and get more dimes.
But again,
there are scenes in there. They're
problematic. We also have the we'd like to hand you a Laurel. And give you a Laurel and hearty handshake. He's holding a Laurel.
Everybody in the town was named Johnson. You know, it was Howard.
Howard Johnson's right. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, it was very clever.
Oh my gosh!
Still with us, thank God. We lost Carl Reiner, but the and by the way, there's a Douglas Fairbanks reference in that film. Harvey Korman. It becomes, he ends up in a movie within a movie, fucking gut, stick out your tush.
Yeah.
DeLuise, and then he jumps out of the movie just as if he's in Sherlock Jr. and runs through the theater out to the forecourt of Grauman's Chinese Theater where he's shot, and down he goes, and he lands right on Douglas Fairbanks's cement block.
Oh, that's right. You're right.
How could he do such great stunts on such little feet and then dies? I've always had a soft spot in my heart for Mel Brooks for that.
Oh my gosh, that you're absolutely right. That is, and I had Christopher Korman, his son, Harvey Korman's son, on here too, and we had a really really wonderful conversation, and he had basically had met just about every 70s movie or TV star that there was.
Oh, I'm sure.
He met them all. It's absolutely amazing.
He and Tim Conway used to crack each other up on the Carol Burnett Show, and they were trying to keep it in and play the scene.
Oh, yeah.
Watching them
try
not to laugh was funnier than the script. It was just...
Yeah, and I think what made that show lovely, which just has nothing to do with Zorro, but that's okay. What made that show so lovely was just the way you could tell that those people on that show genuinely liked each other. Yeah. They genuinely, there wasn't anyone on that program that walked away in a huff. Like even like Andy Griffith's show, they all liked each other except, Frances, how do you say her last name? Bavier or whatever.
B,
she was not pleased with the with her role. She thought she should be the central character. Like, why? You know,
that's the same way Rose Marie was angry at feeling like she was being shoved aside by Mary Tyler Moore's, the emphasis on Mary Tyler Moore's character. But it was always meant to be part of his home life and part of his work life. And, Moore turned out to be such a gifted comedian, and that combination of beauty and comic talent is a glorious, glorious thing. And of course she blew up to marvelous stardom. And that was tough on Rosemary.
Yeah.
Who had worked in the hustings for years, singing vaudeville town to town, since she was 5 years old. This young woman was being worked, and so she had reached a point in her life where, she was in her 40s and was a major figure, and suddenly a 19-year-old bursts out of nowhere and is just making the cover of TV Guide.
You know what? I want to tell you another. We were talking a minute ago about 17-year-olds. Okay. There's something you may or may not know, but if the listeners would know that it's a really interesting fact. Ann Miller was 15 when she was in a romantic role in the Marx Brothers movie Room Service.
And she claims she was extremely young when she made the 1937 Frank Capra You Can't Take It With You, where she plays the guy's wife. If she was 12 years old, if she was 15 years old, I'll eat my hat.
Okay.
A woman lying about her age.
I feel like she said she lied about her age to get in. And then it was convenient.
You look at the signs, and I'm being a clinician again, of sexual development.
Yeah. I wish we could know for sure,
probably Wikipedia has some lies about it, but most of those women lied about their age. Eileen Whitford's biography of Mary Pickford was sort of the opening paragraphs were, hey, we finally found the birth certificate, and it was never 1893, it was 1892. And Pickford, in her autobiography, is claiming she was 12 when she started at Viagra. No, sorry, she was 17. And that's still remarkably young. But that's not 12.
Yeah,
they just, everybody lied about their age. And you can't blame them. The system was set up to reward the young, and the people were playing grandmother roles in their 30s, with white hair and buns. It was the treatment, the ageism, the treatment of women was terrible. So I understand the impulse. There's just a part of me that goes, oh, sister, come on, be authentic. It's over now. Be like Betty White. I'm about to turn 100. She almost made it, and I would argue, and I've said it before, I'll say it again, she had the most beautiful face in Hollywood, because it hadn't been heightened, and she didn't look like a rhesus monkey.
Good point.
You get Joan Rivers, the comedian. She was honest about all of her plastic surgery, and I'm sorry, plastic surgery killed her, or an incompetent.
It sure did.
Which didn't maintain her airway.
Yeah.
Was busy taking selfies. But, this is a town where, as Bob Hope once said, it's good to see all the new faces on top of the old faces. It's a town where you don't see women with crow's feet, with natural aging, with the beauty that comes with a face that is weathered and has character. And, that's because this industry will punish you like you wouldn't believe.
No, it's true. And I've talked before about how, like women when they get their plastic surgery, say, oh, why don't they just age gracefully? And then when they don't, it's like, oh, she really let it all loose, didn't she?
Yeah, you know, let it go.
Yeah, and it's like, yeah, you can't win. You know, when you're 80 years old, you're gonna lose some of what you had when you were 30. Sorry.
And you're just not going to convince me that you're 30.
And yeah.
Of course, what I do is look at the hands, because the hands typically are not, nobody or very rarely is aesthetic work done on the hands. So the hands get wrinkled and veiny, and they get little nodules where the joints are if you're arthritic. And they demonstrate your age. And if your hands don't match your face, something's creepy. But that's me, and I'm being judgy. I should have compassion for women who are scared and men who are scared and insecure and go under the knife. But
it happens.
Yeah.
Well. Well, I want to thank you, Tracy, again for coming on.
Pleasure.
This is your third time coming on. And I want to thank you for signing my book, The First King of Hollywood. When I saw you...
Well, I did a Subway sandwich after my fifth visit.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah.
In my cart.
Yeah, and I saw you in Topeka, Kansas at the Silent Film Festival, Kansas Silent Film Festival, a month before COVID began. And
February 29th.
Yeah, and then...
2 weeks before the world shut down.
Yeah, and then we... Yeah. And then, it was lovely seeing you there, and I was glad that you signed my book, and
we screened some biographs at that.
There was some really good stuff that year. Well, I went again this year. They put it back up this year, and in February this year, and it was.
JB Kaufman was their guest of honor this time, right?
Yeah, I think so. And of course,
me, it was Carrie Beecham. And I usually follow on her coattails. You
and
know?
One of my
can't get her on Dick Gossel.
One of my other podcast guests, Ben Modell, was of course there playing the organ. You probably know Ben, right?
I know his work, and I don't know him well enough where I feel like you'd go Ben, but everybody knows Ben Modell.
He's a lovely man. I think. When he and I talked, I think he was a little frustrated that my equipment was not as advanced as his equipment for his own podcast. His podcast sounds really good, and mine is a little grainy.
Is this
but
about music or what's the topic?
Yeah, he does his own he talks about basically his concept is get inside the mind of somebody that composes music for silent films that are in, and he has to.
There's a book you should read.
Uh-huh.
Everybody should read. It's a biography of Max Steiner, written by Steve.
Oh, yeah. One of the best, yeah.
Oh, my God, the best. I've never understood or appreciated music until I started to read his book and read his explanation. So as I read the book, I slowly went through, okay, first thing we're going to see is the Most Dangerous Game, then we go to King Kong, and I appreciated, the Betty Davis weepies. I appreciated those films and those scores so much more after reading his work.
Yeah,
it gives me a depth, just a brilliant man, and yet he can communicate with people like me who know nothing about music. And it's the biography of Max Steiner. I think that's the name of the book. Let me look it up.
Okay. Yeah, he was definitely the best of his time. I just can't.
Steiner was wonderful, but this book is. Let me just get to smile.amazon.com. By Max Steiner is the name of the book. It's on sale now on Amazon, 23% off hardcover. The Epic Life of Hollywood's Most Influential Composer. It just came out about a year ago, May 2020. It took me that long to work my way through the films. So it's like a year later, I'm saying, yeah, you've got to read this book. But it really will enrich your understanding. Of course, he did the music for Casablanca.
Yeah, absolutely, and, you know,
he hated the song As Time Goes By.
He did.
From the early 30s. He hated it, but he took that song and he worked it into the thing. He made that song speak.
Yeah, it's to me,
it had been a popular song that came and flunked and went away in a matter of weeks in the early 30s, not written by him. Mm-hmm. He took that song through his orchestration and his placement of it emotionally in the minds of the characters.
Okay.
And made it something so rich and so wonderful. And of course, he could have written a piece of music that would have served that function in the movie, but the director or the writer or the producer wanted specifically As Time Goes By. And even though he hated the song, what he did with it and what a supreme craftsman he was. Again, he did music for Gone with the Wind, obviously.
Yeah.
So if you love any of those classic films, one of the reasons you may love them, Mildred Pierce.
You know, the list is forever. Yeah.
Yeah, it just the list is forever.
Yeah, he just.
And, just read this book.
Yeah, that's really just, I mean, it's, you know, there's not very many that can say they match up to him. Certainly
you
no
one. Have him on your podcast.
Oh, you mean the author of the book? Oh, yeah.
No, not Steiner.
No, not yet. Steiner's not available.
But, Stephen Smith lives
in
Palm Desert. He's
found enough. I'll definitely look into that because I think that's. That's a great subject. That's a great subject.
Yeah, and he's an articulate guy and gives talks about... he also wrote the book on Bernard Herrmann and his music.
I did a tribute to Ennio Morricone when he died. And I did a little tribute to him. People... I was just commenting the other day about how one of the things I like about watching movies from the 80s is... You can sometimes see those old Hollywood stars. They're still around, and they show up. You know, even Lauren Bacall was in a movie in
Trading Places.
Yeah.
It's
so fun to watch those old Hollywood people later, and it's just and when I was a kid watching movies like that, I sort of took it for granted. Like they were just old guys, you know, but. Then, you know, when you learn a little bit, I realize, I've seen Ralph Bellamy, you know, 25 times in a movie now.
Yeah, he was in that Irene Dunn.
He's all over the place. You know, and
John Amici invented the telephone.
That's right. He's all over the place.
Yeah.
All over the place. And I started watching classic films when I was about probably 10. My gateway was Laurel and Hardy. And Charlie Chaplin, and then what's that?
That's a wonderful entry.
Yeah, and then and the Marx Brothers, and you know, but some of my friends would say the Three Stooges, but I'm not really that into them.
I outgrew them when I was 4, but that's a woman thing.
I will say that Disorder in the Court is a really great short film, but. I watched movies with my mom, and we did a lot of bonding together. What's that? Yeah, she is. Yeah. Matter of fact, my air conditioner went out 2 weeks ago, and I had to spend the night at her place 2 nights in a row, and we just sat there and watched movies just like the old days, just like 40 years ago.
You lose them so quickly.
Oh gosh, yeah. I lost my dad a few months ago, and it was just.
I'm actually glad your AC broke because you may look back later and say, "Hey, I had those two nights."
Yeah. I was saying earlier today that I actually really enjoyed going over there. I just didn't like her couch.
Well, then buy her a new one, Mike.
There you go. That's what I need to do. But it's just so great talking with you, and I hope that do you normally get to the San Francisco Silent Film Festival?
I used to. I have not been up there in a number of years, and that's because I go to Pordenone now every year. And what happens is they often select the films that they're going to screen from some of the best that screened at Pordenone.
Uh-huh.
So if I had just seen it the year before, yeah, a schlep to San Francisco is a little less tempting for me. That said, the people, I would love to see the people.
Yeah.
I mean, Rob Byrne helped me. The first two restorations we ever did were Rob Byrne's work, and he's the head of San Francisco Silent Film Festival. You know, the people that you see who are attending, it's just so wonderful to go and to be with your family, in a sense, to be with that community. But it's a big deal for me to be able to kind of cough up the airfare and to go to Pordenone once a year.
Yeah.
And then seeing the internet, the people from the International Archives, which for us at Film Preservation Society is critical, because guess what? The gold and glitter, the Biograph, the only place it exists is a single copy in Tokyo. You know, if I want to get every Biograph, by God, I better be talking to the folks in Brussels and the folks in London and such.
So, they're all over the place. And
yeah.
As the years go on, here's the real problem is when people like you and I are no longer here, and I don't think I'd be in much help anyway, but when people discover films that were once lost, they don't know what it is. They look at it and they're like, I see this old film and there's like fragments of it, but they can't identify which film it is. And that's a real problem.
The thing was the Lon Chaney film, The Unknown, was lost for years.
Yeah.
And you go through an archive, but people don't know what a thing is. They write unknown on it, right?
Yeah.
So you open up the can that says unknown and it was The Unknown.
Oh, dear.
The person didn't write the word the.
I didn't know that.
Can.
Oh,
and
that's wow.
How they found The Unknown. And so I know there are going to be more treasures out there. It's not just,
yeah.
You know, the wonderful Laurel and Hardy that was recently discovered.
Oh, there was a new Laurel and Hardy movie we discovered?
Well, no, it was it was a few years ago. The you know, the one with the big...
Oh, the bandit one?
The pie fight one.
Oh, yes, yes.
You will find the century.
Yeah. That they showed that at Kansas Film Festival a while back.
And you know, the discovery of one of the Keystones, where Chaplin made a short appearance as a Keystone cop in. And
is that right? Wow, I did not know that.
Found that, who is one of the major Roscoe Arbuckle people. He bought it at a yard sale. Unknown film.
Yeah. And that's something.
It was an unknown Chaplin appearance.
That's just amazing.
Yeah. So who knows? And the poster turning up for that Biograph. a cry for help that we restored. You know, there are 450 Biographs. Somebody calls me and says, we found a Biograph poster. Are you interested? You know, what are the odds that it's going to be a cry for help? Usually when things are found, they're found in groups. So there's, you know, more than one copy of Three Friends. There's more than one copy of, the French Revolution one. I'm blanking on the name. But the fact that there would be a single copy of the film, and it's one that we worked so hard to restore, it's just thrilling to me. So I just have to live long enough, and the Robin Hood three sheets going to turn out.
Yeah, there you go.
Plan.
Well,
I live. You know, you were born in the 70s. I was born in the 50s. So, you know, I'm on Medicare, so people get start looking fast because I'm not going to last forever.
Yeah, we all have an expiration date. I'm going to send you a link to Glenn Andreev's page, because his Vimeo page, because that'll have that lost emulsion. I think you'll find that documentary fascinating. How much you're going to learn, I'm not sure, because you might know almost everything that's on it. But there are some real nice little nuggets of information that he's got on there, and he talks about a lot of lost films that were recently found, and some that are still lost, and he did another movie called Found Emulsion. I thought the first one was a lot better because it was a little longer, but I think there's more information in it, but Found Emulsion is really great too, but Glenn. One of the absolute champions of old Hollywood. He just absolutely, and he loves silent films too. But like I told you earlier, I've had two young women on my program that are in their 20s.
You converted them.
Yeah. Well, I didn't convert them. They were already there, but somebody did it. Somebody did it to them.
Films to young people, everybody.
Yeah,
and the next generation needs to come.
I have a friend of mine that lives 5 minutes from me. I grew up with him. I've known him since kindergarten, and he said he watched the movie Gilda because I did a podcast episode on it, and I'm like, it's working. Oh, us.
Did he think the subtext of Gilda was a hetero and homosexual triangle? Meaning,
no, he didn't really get into that. He didn't get into that at all. He didn't really get into the particulars. He just
that's
said.
That's what people are now saying, that Gilda.
I've heard that, and I briefly mentioned it on the episode. That was 3 years ago. I'm trying to remember exactly what I said. When I do a podcast episode, like on a particular movie, I tend to watch it, and then sometimes I'll rewatch it, and then I'll re-watch it one more time. Like I did one on the movie Sideways from 2004.
I remember that.
I saw that movie probably 12 times, in preparation for the podcast, because there's so much to take in,
Did you want to go to wine country and drink?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, that's, I've been wanting to go there forever. And I've been to California once. That was, 93, but I was just in the Los Angeles area and we did the Hollywood thing. We did do it at Disneyland and we did all this, the Los Angeles thing.
Your buddy was so brilliant.
No, he was. And I talked with two of the people from that movie, the two of the servers. I wanted to talk to Virginia Madsen is like one of my dream guests. I've been thinking about this podcast episode for like 4 years. And
didn't
she
play Marion Davies in a
did she? I don't know. I don't know.
I'm running your podcast so long. I'm sorry.
No, you're okay.
I'm sorry.
No, you're fine. You're fine. As a matter of fact, this is gonna be a rough cut. It's gonna go right up tomorrow.
I'm looking up Virginia Madsen to see if earlier.
Okay, so we just talked with Tracy Gozell. She is the author of the First King of Hollywood, all about Douglas Fairbanks, and also is in charge of the Biograph Project. So please, if you can't give to the Biograph Project, at least like the page on Facebook, look it up, and there's a lot of treasures that Tracy has been trying to put back in the public sphere, and we're grateful for that. I want to say thank you very much for Tracy coming on here, and it was wonderful talking with her, and thank you for listening.